Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Jeff Charlotte. And we're going to be talking about his book, The Family. Now, Jeff has written a fascinating discussion about an organization that is so powerful that most of you who have never heard of it. Now, you may very well have heard of the Presidential Prayer Breakfast, which is held every year, and most people think that that has to do with the president, and the president is usually there speaking, and Christian leaders come from all across the country to attend the Presidential Prayer Breakfast. But that is probably one of the most overt of their activities, the group that they call the family, because most of it, what they do is done quite covertly, and very, very few people even realize that this powerful organization with tentacles into every aspect of our government and countries throughout the world really exists. And so I'm going to let Jeff tell you about it, because he actually lived on their compound for some time. And, well, it's a fascinating story. Jeff, why did you pick the story up?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Well, I began with this story way back in 2001, actually. I write about religion. I'm a journalist. I write for various magazines and so on. And a longtime friend called me up and said, I'm worried that my brother has joined a cult. And this is a family of conservative Christians. And this young man, Zeke, I call him in the book, is the only person's name I've changed to just because he's sort of a vulnerable character. He had left a career in finance and left his fiance and moved across the country to join the family. And they asked me, the family, not the group, but his relatives said, would you have dinner with Zeke and see what he's up to, because we know you write a lot about religion. And when I did, what he told me about this organization was just really surprising to me. Now, I thought I understood Christian fundamentals in the United States, and I understand a lot of your listeners, we have different ideas about what fundamentalism means. But it's safe to say I thought it was best represented by figures like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson. I learned very quickly how little I knew. Here was a group in the heart of Washington. The organizers of the National Prayer Breakfast, as you said, its membership made up entirely of elite, and its theology, its ideas, almost alien to anything that I had ever encountered in a church before. And as I say, I write about religion. I spend a lot of time in churches. They had a very different concept of Jesus. And so that was when I began researching the group and spent about five. I went and I lived with them for a while, and I wrote about that for Harper's Magazine, and then spent years and years sifting through archives around the country, and particularly their archives at the Billy Graham Center in Wheaton, Illinois. And that's how I was able to make my book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power.
All right, fine. Have you ever been threatened, or certainly anything been done to silence you? Because, of course, you have dealt with certainly one of the most covert and powerful organizations in our nation.
You know, it's interesting. I wish I could claim that my book was more successful. There was moments when I first published the first article about them in Harper's, and around that time, the Los Angeles Times had also done a year-long investigation of the family. So they were starting to get some heat. And this group has existed for 70 years. They don't like the spotlight. They are very sort of behind the scenes. So they really sort of try to avoid scrutiny. So they weren't happy with it. Let me give you a little quote.
All right, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Jeff Sharp. The subject of family, a fascinating one. Go right ahead, Jeff.
Hi, Sam. Well, you know, this group, it's a sort of a secretive group. I don't want to call it a conspiracy or anything like that, but they are secretive. They do try to avoid publicity. Doug Coe, the leader of the group, listed by Time magazine as the fourth most powerful evangelical in America, whatever that's worth.
Well, I think that's a very important statement. Here's a Time magazine, certainly people who really know what's going on, calling Doug Coe the fourth most powerful evangelical in America. And I dare say that very, very few people listening to this audience, which is predominantly evangelical and fundamentalist audience, has ever heard of Doug Coe, but there's a reason. Go right ahead.
Well, because the reason he doesn't want you to hear about him. Here's Doug Coe preaching a sermon, which you actually can find online at the website of the Navigators. The family functions invisibly, like the mafia. They keep the organization invisible. Everything visible is transitory. Everything invisible is permanent and lasts forever. The more you can make your organization invisible, the more influence it will have. And indeed, the organization does have a tremendous amount of influence. Its membership, as I said, is comprised almost entirely of elite. Unlike most Christians, they don't see their mission as the salvation of souls. They believe that God works through a specially anointed elite, that God chooses just a few people. And that God doesn't really care about your soul or mine. He only cares about the elite, his congressmen, his senators, his ambassadors, his businessmen. And if he can get those guys, then he's happy. Well, a group like this is powerful enough that they don't need to threaten me when I write this book. And yet, when I first published the story that became the book, The Family, in Harper's Magazine, they did respond. I mean, in kind of remarkable ways. And I tell that story in Chapter 9 of The Family. For instance, Senator Dan Coates, former Senator Dan Coates of Indiana, had a speaking engagement in Germany, a series paid for by the U.S. Embassy. And when I get there, my German host said, there's a problem. Your ambassador says he cannot pay for you. He says, you are an enemy of Jesus. It was almost too hard to believe, but so it was. Unfortunately, the German university that invited me made up the cost. But there was no real threat. They're not going to commit violence. It's this kind of intimidation tactic. And it's based on this idea that Jesus is somehow sort of their private property, that Jesus is not to be shared with everybody, that Jesus is to be maintained as a separate preserve, a reserve for the powerful, or the up and out, as they call them. And that's their approach to the world. And so, no, they've not threatened me. They keep tabs on me. They call up. They see what I'm doing. They remain very secretive.
Hold that thought, Jeff. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I just asked Jeff, of course, if they'd ever really been threatened after he wrote his book. He said that they keep tabs on him. They let him know that they're watching and monitoring him. But it's almost implied rather than overt. And, of course, these people have an entirely different view of Christianity. They don't believe Christianity is for everybody. It's for an elite, especially when the congressmen, the people who have the positions of power, they're the ones they want to work for. And this has, in my estimation, certainly the discussion of Christianity, but I believe it's a power effort on the part of a small elite group, because these are elitists who want to use Christianity as a power, as a basis for their power. Would you say that would be an accurate appraisal of it, Jeff?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It is a religion of status quo power. It is the idea, when most of us read the New Testament, when we read the words of Jesus, we see a message of love or forgiveness or mercy or justice. When the family, going back to the 1930s when it began, when they read it, they saw a message of power. If that's the bottom line, that's a common denominator, power. And that's what separates them from the great majority of Christians in the world.
Well, I certainly have to question. I'm sure some of the people that fit in may have Christian leanings, but of course this is not the message of Jesus Christ, nor the Jesus Christ that I worship and accept as my God. But unfortunately, there are these forces within Christianity who pretend to be Christians and yet use the veneer of Christianity to push a goal. Now, you said the organization began back in the 30s, so why don't we start at the very beginning and bring it right up to date and to their power position in Washington, D.C. and throughout the world today?
Sure, Dr. Stan. They began back in 1935. The founder group, a man named Abraham Baradi, was concerned about, he didn't like the New Deal, he didn't like Franklin Roosevelt, but unlike most people who disagree with someone politically, he decided not to take his concerns public and support a different candidate or something like that, but rather to organize a group of very wealthy businessmen, none of them churchgoers, by the way. They weren't particularly Christian men. They were more concerned with their own wealth, and organize them together, and that they would try and affect a campaign for politics, first in their home state of Washington, and by 1942, with the help of some of these wealthy men like Henry Ford and J.C. Penney, he had moved to Washington, D.C. He tells his whole story, by the way, and there is a book that he had published for his members called Modern Viking. He styles himself a modern Viking, and that's the autobiography of Abraham Beatty. Pretty hard to find, but if you have a really good library, you might find an old copy of it. And I was able to verify the story in archives around the country. And what they were doing, first, was fighting organized labor. They did not like organized labor. But secondly, what they were doing was reaching out to fascist sympathizers, and after the war, after World War II, actual former Nazis, like Hermann Abs, who was known as Hitler's banker, the man who helped spirit out untold just bushels of money with the Nazis who fled to South America after the war. Really terrible guy. Konstantin von Neurath, one of the seven major war criminals. These were these guys that they would go and they say, look, if you would switch your allegiance from the Führer to the Father, as it were, from Hitler to Christ, that's all it is. Really what it is, they're not talking about Christ. They're talking about this ideal of power, and they give it a different name. And that's just kind of the early roots of the organization.
All right, fine. And so, of course, this gentleman worked there behind the scenes for some time. Where did Doug Coe come into this issue and take control of the organization?
Doug Coe, who leads the family to this day, got involved in 1959 when he was a young Oregonian, moved to Washington, D.C. And up to that point, he had been on a pretty standard evangelical track, had a good record is working with groups like Young Life and the Navigators and so on, but immediately was drawn into this world of very high power politics. And I was able to, through his letters home, which are stored in this archive, I was able to sort of track his evolution from being just kind of a small town boy to being this guy who was very impressed by power and didn't really care what its trappings were. So, for instance, one of his first clients, one of the first guys he went to bat for, was a dictator named Papadoc Duvalier, was the longtime dictator of Haiti, the guy who his death squads were called the Tonton Macoutes, a really, really murderous character, not someone you'd think a Christian would get behind. Very literally, it sounds like a crazy story, but Papadoc was famous for using voodoo against his enemies, and even more disastrously, using bullets and machetes against his enemies. But Doug Coe was very impressed with him, and he worked with two senators, Frank Carlson from Kansas and Homer Capehart from Indiana. And they arranged for American support for this dictator, whom they deemed a man of God. Why did they see him as a man of God? Because one thing Papadoc was good for was the business interests of the members of the family.
And so then they were able then to have their friends invest in Haiti and do quite well?
That's sad to say. That's so much the history of the Cold War. I mean, you have this very honorable struggle against the Soviet Union, honorable struggle against communism, and then you have these guys coming in and working the angles. Another client of Doug Coe's, and perhaps the worst in just the pantheon of dictators, for whom these guys have effectively almost acted as a sort of de facto lobbyist in the United States, was a man named Suharto, General Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia, killed anywhere, scholars say he killed about 1.8 million of his own citizens, the most conservative estimate, even the U.S. government says by the most conservative estimate he killed 600,000 of his own citizens, and he did so, here's the horrible part, He did so with weaponry supplied entirely by the United States.
Well, now, he was the man, of course, who overthrew Sukarno, and, of course, they justified the slaughter because supposedly these people were communists. But even if they're communists, we should never back people who act like communists, and Suharto did that. And, of course, I've heard figures as high as 3 million people. You know, the canals there in Indonesia were just filled with bodies. But exactly. We never hear this. Of course, he had the full backing of the American government at the time, the Central Intelligence Agency was certainly behind the overthrow of Sukarno and the installation of Suharto there in Indonesia. I can remember very well when that happened. So, and Doug Coe was somehow involved with that, or the family was?
Doug Coe, early on, right at the beginning, the family sent a series of emissaries to meet with Suharto, and they determined he was a man of God. Now, remember, Suharto was technically a Muslim. But I don't think he was even really that. He was a man of power and a man of wealth, and he ran Suharto's massive oil industry. People forget a lot of oil comes from Indonesia, and he ran that as a sort of a personal bank account. By the late 60s and early 70s, what I discovered in the archive is through the family you would see delegations of congressmen and oil executives going over through Doug Coe's leadership to pray with Suharto, and they would come back, and they would actually, I discovered in various archives, memos, a memo prepared by Senator Mark Hatfield, a memo prepared by Senator B. Everett Jordan for Nixon, describing the family's connection to Suharto as a backdoor channel through which we can do business with this man who is so crucially important if you want to make a lot of money, and so absolutely disastrous for human rights. And you said, you know, of course, we don't want to in fighting communists, we don't want to act like communists. And, you know, one of the important, the clear thing to say about Suharto is when he went out to kill communists, and I put that in quotes, he would not discriminate. He would eradicate entire villages. We're talking infants, old men, old women. I mean, it was one of the horrible genocides of the 20th century. And all along, Doug Coe was continually vouching for this guy. They even brought him over to the United States in the early 70s to meet with a meeting of the Senate Weekly Prayer Breakfast, at which they brought Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, because they thought this was such a good man of God. And it's the tragedy of American foreign policy is that, you know, we the citizens oftentimes support these things believing in the good intentions of our leaders and not understanding that this wasn't realpolitik. This was murder politik.
You know, what was a part did Senator Mark Hatfield play? Of course, most people thought he was a Christian. He professed to be a Christian. He was the senator from Oregon for many years, but he was also very deeply involved with the family, wasn't he?
He was, and a very interesting character. I do believe he was a Christian. I also believe that at times, I think, like so many senators, he was blinded by ambition and power. I think I spent a lot of time going over Hatfield's papers. Hatfield was a man who wanted to do the right thing, but he loved this idea that through the family he could talk to any foreign leader in the world, that he had this kind of foreign policy power that even most senators don't have. And I think he was willing to overlook the murderousness of the people he was dealing with, and not just overlook it, to whitewash it and to channel U.S. dollars.
And, of course, I think the interesting thing is that to the family, he was able to get access to world leaders, access that if he were not affiliated with the family, he wouldn't have. And
yeah.
I think what people really don't understand is this is not simply an American organization, is it?
No. It's really an international organization. There's a man named David Kuo who the special assistant to President Bush during his first term, was the guy who was effectively in charge of running faith-based initiatives. He was also the guy who actually wrote the legislation that led to faith-based initiatives when he was working for Senator John Ashcroft. And I will say this for David, who I know and respect. He is an honest broker in many ways. And one of the things he said, he is a supporter of the family. He likes the family. He said in his book, Tempting Faith, he said, the family's reach in the governments around the world is almost impossible to overstate or even grasp.
But, of course, David Koh had the courage to speak out against what was going on in the White House and how they at one time would smile at the evangelicals and pat them on the back, and the next time when they were gone, they'd laugh and ridicule them. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jeff Shaw. Do you know how to get hold of David Koh? I've tried repeatedly and been blocked at every turn. Is he available, do you know?
When we're off the air, I can get you his email.
All right, fine. That's what we'll do. I'll call you.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
When the family began it, it was something they'd been wanting to do for a long time. They wanted an annual ritual that would sort of merge church and state. Now, I'm going to say this with respect for those who think that separation of church and state is perhaps too strict and so on. What the family had in mind is not anything that I think any Christian knew what they were doing would admire. What they wanted to do was make a power ritual. This was, it's idolatry. They're idolizing power, and they had a hard time doing it for many years because Franklin Roosevelt wouldn't do it. Truman, who was actually a very devout Christian, would not do it. He recognized the separation of church and state. And Eisenhower, who came in, did not want to do it. Eisenhower said, no, this is unconstitutional. This is an insult to religion. This is an insult to government. This is not how we do it. But Eisenhower had to do it because the family, a figure named Senator Frank Carlson, who was Eisenhower's right-hand man, helped get Eisenhower elected. It was another senator from Kansas. And he had been Eisenhower's liaison to Billy Graham. Billy Graham organized an evangelical vote for Eisenhower. And this was the first time in decades that an evangelical vote had been mobilized like that. Well, you know, Eisenhower's not the worst president. We don't want to put that down as a great tragedy. But the one sad thing of it was Eisenhower felt like he had to pay back the favor and go to the National Prayer Breakfast in 1953. He worried it was going to set a precedent. It did. Every president since has gone, and it has become a massive, grotesque lobbying festival. And the easiest way to understand what's going on there is to look at the guest list. Most of Congress goes, of course. All the big ones go. About 4,000 people at the Washington Hilton every year. Look at the foreign guests. The family pays for foreign guests from around the world to come, and they invite delegations from every nation. Often as not, usually more often, that delegation from a foreign nation, from a country like Albania, Romania, Croatia, is led by their Minister of Defense. Now, what is this coincidence that the Minister of Defense just happens to be the most Christian man in all these countries? Well, of course not. They're there to lobby, and that was made plain some years ago in Taiwan when an entrepreneurial reporter discovered that the Taiwanese government was paying pretty large sums of money to the family for a good table at the family and put it in the newspaper, said, what's this about? The Taiwanese government did not blink an eye. They did not dissemble. They were very straightforward. They say, look, if for $10,000 we can buy state time with the United States, the President of the United States, that's the best deal going. This is access. We're buying access. It is very plain. And that's what the family is using. They're using the access that they have to the powerful. As one government informant says, look, if Doug Koch can get you state time with the President, that's real power.
And now, what is a seat at the National Prayer Breakfast cost, you know, or what does a table cost if you're going to buy a whole table?
Relatively not that much, $425.
Well, that $425 is a lot of money to me. Maybe not to a rich writer like you.
Well, I wish I'll have to sign a little more books before that becomes a reasonable price for breakfast. But I mean to say, you know, that's not where the money is happening. You know, one of the interesting things about the family, and I think that raised my attention and NBC when they investigated, LA Times when they investigated, is that most of the money is off the books. And they're, in fact, they're open to it. If you look at the family's tax record, you'll see, you know, about $15 million a year. It's not very well accounted for. The biggest line item in their budget, something like $12 million, is making friends. Now, I don't know about you, Dr. Stan, but it doesn't cost me $12 million a year to make friends. In fact, I tend to think if I have to pay them a lot of money, they're not really my friends. But that's what that's the official budget. But within the organization, and what they do is they create any number of nonprofits that they open and close, so that, as one leader of the family explained to me, he said, it's sort of like the mafia, but we don't want to create an institution. We don't effectively want to create a paper trail. The paper trail is there, but it's hard to follow. And I did follow it, and what you see is that money is moving off the books. As Doug Koh likes to say, he says, I lend money to hundreds of people, or have my friends lend money. And what this means, there's actually an expose of this in the 1970s, and of all places, Playboy magazine, which once used to be serious investigative journalism, and they discovered that the family was operating as a bank for congressmen who were in trouble. And you know who they specialize in? Folks who are under ethics investigation. You're under an ethics investigation, you're in trouble, you need money, go to the family, and they will loan you money, no interest, and they'll never ask for it back. So that's the kind of thing that's going on, and that's the kind of thing that's happening on a grand scale at the National Prayer Breakfast.
And, of course, what you're really talking about, of course, is buying congressmen. If you lend them money and they don't have to pay it back, That's a pretty good deal. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jeff Charlotte. We're talking about the family, and of course, do we have any idea? You say that their income tax form suggests they have about $15 million a year, but is there other money out there? Because it must be expensive to run those large homes, to provide travel facilities, to be able to send people all throughout the world. That doesn't come cheap.
Yeah, that's exactly how the money works. So, for instance, their headquarters is in Arlington, Virginia. It's at the end of a cul-de-sac. It's a beautiful mansion called the Cedars. They bought it in the late 1970s. But now they didn't. That money didn't go directly to them. What they did was they put up. They put together a coalition of wealthy men who bought the mansion and then gifted it to them. So again, that's not going to show up as part of that $15 million. That mansion is today worth, I think, close to $5 million. They bought it with money. You go back and look at the records. One of the big backers was a guy named Tom Phillips, who was then the CEO of Raytheon, the major defense contractor. And through the family, Tom Phillips was able to have regular access to men like Melvin Laird, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Hatfield, all these various senators with whom they could have these sort of off-the-record conversations. That's where the money is moving. Another example I give in the book is their relationship with the tiny, just wrecked country of Somalia, which they kind of focused in the 80s. And what they did was they focused in on this little dictator. This dictator wanted guns from America, so they created a prayer cell for him. And the members of this prayer cell, who were going to meet with him regularly and help him understand Jesus, Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa, who I think actually has good intentions but rather naive guy, a West German Bundestag member, and a defense contractor named Bill Brehm. And what happens? Well, Somalia's defense budget gets nearly doubled by the United States. These politicians go to back for them. They say, let's help this guy out. Let's double his defense budget. Who are they buying the guns from? Well, they're buying the guns with this money that the American taxpayer is giving them. They're buying the guns from these defense contractors who are getting enriched. And what does Somalia do with these guns? This insane dictator, Siad Barre, uses them to wage war on his own people. And if your listeners out there are familiar with the story of Black Hawk Down or the ongoing nightmare in Somalia, that country has never recovered from that little scheme.
Well, of course, it's really people are responsible for what they do, and the last thing we should be doing is supporting dictators throughout the world under any circumstances, for whatever reason. You may say, well, they're on our side against the terrorists, they're on our side against the communists. It doesn't matter. You have to do what's morally right. We'll be right back with Jeff. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jeff Charlotte. We're talking about the family, an organization which most people have never heard of, and yet it works with tentacles throughout the world. Now, my understanding is that a number of congressmen will be actually living at this mansion in Virginia. In other words, they're working in Washington, D.C. They don't want to have an apartment. And how many congressmen actually ordinarily live there with the family? And I'm sure they get a very good room rate, and they get their meals as well, don't they?
Well, the family actually owns quite a number of properties. Just in that little cul-de-sac in Arlington, there's about 20 houses associated with them. They have another set up like that in Annapolis. Congressmen don't live at that mansion, the Cedars. They have another property right across from the offices of Congress called the House on C Street. And this is, you can go there and see it. It's right there. The address is in the book, so I'm not giving away any secrets. This is registered as a nonprofit. It's registered as a church so that they don't have to pay any taxes on it. It's on Capitol Hill on C Street. And at any given time, not very many, maybe 8 congressmen live there at a given time. Guys like Representative Zach Womp of Tennessee has lived there. Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas has lived there. I met John Ensign there, Senator John Ensign of Nevada, the casino gambling heir, when he was living there. A lot of guys sort of cycle through that place and spend some time living at below market rates. and living under the sort of the spiritual tutelage of Doug Coe. And for instance, I sat in on one of Doug Coe's spiritual tutoring sessions with Congressman Todd Tehart, Republican of Kansas, pretty standard conservative evangelical guy talking about these things. And what Doug Coe is teaching him, no, the issues you seem to care about, like abortion and so on, these issues, yeah, whatever, they don't really matter. What matters is this kind of total Jesus plus nothing. And the way he translated that is, what does Jesus have to say about Social Security? What does Jesus have to say about building roads? And Doug Coe's answer is always, 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 there's only one answer, privatize, 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 privatize. Is this because they're great libertarians? Absolutely not. It's because in the domestic scene, they're doing the same thing that happens in Somalia. You privatize, and the deal goes to your friends. And your friends get rich. As one of my friends at the Cato Institute, which is a very conservative libertarian group, but no fan of the family, said, this isn't free market economics. This is crony economics. This is crony capitalism. This isn't real capitalism. It's self-interest by proxy.
All right. Well, I certainly would not disagree with that. Certainly, one of the interesting things you brought up would be Chuck Colson. And you commented that, you know, when Chuck Colson, of course, he's eventually, of course, indicted because of his nefarious activities in the Nixon administration, you know, he needs help, and the family's there to help him. And for a time, he was quite close to the family, but to his credit, apparently, he's moved away from this power structure. Would you like to discuss a little bit about Chuck Colson, because I think that's important?
I think Chuck Colson's one of the most interesting characters in American politics. You know, probably many of your listeners remember he was one of the Nixon's dirty tricksters, probably the smartest of them, brilliant, brilliant man, very tough, very fierce. And as he faced prison time, the family reached out and recruited him, actually working through the man I mentioned before, Tom Phillips, the CEO of Raytheon, the defense contractor. They brought him in. You know, he served a very short prison sentence. He likes to make this sort of this deal as if he spent a lot of time in prison, and, you know, in the big house and so on. He was 7 months in a very cushy jail, and the family wrote letters and was basically able to get him out of prison early. I have the letters that they wrote to the parole board saying he's needed for work. Now, here's the interesting thing. He came out and he writes not long after that, he says, I discovered that which I could not accomplish through politics, I could accomplish through working through religion. And I think that's the most, really, frankly, the most damning comment of all. That shows that he has not, at this point, really embraced a new life, a new spiritual life. He's pursuing the same political goals. He's using the religious veneer to pursue them. Now, since then, he's done some good work and he's done some bad work. He's still a very rough character. I spent some time talking to him. His letters are sometimes frightening to behold. He's one of these guys who also thinks that there's something to be learned from the leadership lessons of Hitler. But he does break with the family. And why is that? It's because even Chuck Colson says, hey, wait a minute, these guys, they have no doctrine. They have no theology. Their beliefs are flexible. They believe whatever helps them be in power. And whatever else you want to say about Chuck Colson, he's a serious thinker about Christianity. I don't agree with a lot of his views, but I do have read many of his books. I know he thinks about it. And so he eventually moved away from the family.
Well, I think that's really to his credit, then.
Yeah, it is. I think it is, too. I mean, I don't want to give too much credit to Chuck Colson, because I think Chuck Colson has, unfortunately, the lessons that, you know, he learned his Christianity from the family. That was where it began. And he got some sort of very confusing ideas there. You know, he got this idea of biblical capitalism, which, you know, the Bible tells us a great deal about how we might want to deal with others and fairness and so on. But anybody who starts talking about biblical capitalism and that the Bible has a specific economic plan for this or that, that person's trying to sell you a bridge. And I think in the past couple of weeks, we've seen how well that approach works.
Well, somebody had written in and asked about Hillary's involvement with the family. Does Hillary Clinton have any involvement with the family, or Bill?
Bill, not so much, but Hillary, yes. And I devote a chapter in the book to Hillary Clinton's relationship. And I want to emphasize, I've been talking a lot about some conservative politicians, but here's the deal with the family. They work with conservatives. They work with liberals. Their bottom line is power.
I think that's the point you make so clear in your book.
Yes.
This is all about power. And Jesus Christ was never about power. He was about transforming the lives of individuals.
And speaking truth to power.
Right.
And being a witness for truth. Exactly. That's a Christ they don't know. Hillary Clinton, their relationship with Hillary Clinton began. I tell the story in the book, The Family. I first learned about this when I was living with them. The first chapter of the book, I talk about the month I spent living with them in this house being where they are sort of training younger men for leadership in the family. And they would talk about Hillary Clinton. I was rather surprised that they said, oh, yeah, Hillary is a friend of the family. Not a member, but a friend. But that turns out to be a sort of a semi-formal designation. A friend is someone with whom you work. And as I poked around, some of it, again, this is why I said they're not a conspiracy. They're secretive, but they're not a conspiracy. You can find this information if you poke around. Hillary writes in her biography, Living History, that when she came to Washington in 1993, she went to Doug Coe, whom she knew through the Arkansas governor's prayer breakfast, and said, would you put together a prayer cell of women for me? And he did. James Baker's wife, James Baker, the Bush administration fixer, Jack Kemp's wife, wife of a conservative Democrat named Tony Hall, and he put this together, this group. Now, Hillary grew closer to Doug Coe. She refers to him as a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. And for listeners who's tuning in, I want to remind them that Hillary is saying this of a man who thinks that there are leadership lessons to be learned from Hitler, Lenin, and Mao. Now, I'm not trying to smear Hillary. I think Hillary never heard this kind of Hitler talk. That's what's going on here, though, is the family is cultivating power. Well, Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says, we work with power where we can, build new power where we can. And they're interested in Hillary as long as she's powerful. I was wrap this up with another sort of similar story of a South African leader, a guy named Mangosuthu Buthelezi, chief of the Zulus, which means he's a very powerful guy in South Africa. The family courted him, supported him, sent him congressmen, sent him businessmen, sent him investments, made him a wealthy man, helped him out, because they thought he was going to be the first black leader of South Africa. He was a brother forever, they said. You are a brother in our family. We'll never forget you. 1994, Nelson Mandela was elected, and that's the last Mangosuthu Buthelezi ever heard of him. He was heartbroken. He thought that these guys were his true friends. That's how the family deals with people. They'll be interested in Hillary Clinton as long as she's powerful, and if she ever becomes not powerful, they're not going to be interested in her. That's why they're interested in Republicans, they're interested in Democrats, they're interested in communists, they're interested in fascists, they're interested in Muslims like Suharto and the Somali dictator Siad Barre. They're evangelicals, but they're interested in Catholic leaders. They're interested in anyone who can bring them closer to power.
Well, do they work with the Catholics, leading Catholics in the country?
Some. They do work with some Catholics. For a long time, they did not have very great friendships with Catholics. In fact, one of the interesting things I discovered as I went through their archives is as they branched out into Europe during the Cold War, setting up sort of branches in the various European nations, the one country they could not get into was Spain under the late dictator, General Franco. Not much to admire about Franco, but you got to give him credit. He was serious about his Catholicism. And he looked at these guys and said, these guys are evangelical missionaries. I'm not interested in talking to them. Well, they managed to get into Spain anyway. They worked through the offices of Standard Oil. Standard Oil set them up with an office and said, you can get in there. Eventually, they were able to make contact with the Catholic group Opus Dei, which is a similar kind of organization, kind of secretive, very elitist, and interested in sort of ministering only to mainly to the powerful. And they were able to make that friendship. And that's when they started really working with Catholics. Senator Sam Brownback is a great example. I got to spend a lot of time with Senator Brownback, his office in Washington, in Kansas, and I tell that story in the book. Senator Brownback, as some listeners may know, ran for Congress in 1994. At the time, he was a Methodist, got to Washington, saw which way the wind was blowing, became an evangelical. In 2002, converted to Catholicism through Opus Dei's K Street Center. Opus Dei actually runs a chapel on K Street, the main lobbying quarter of Washington. Today, Sam Brownback goes to Catholic Mass, he goes to Evangelical Church, And he is a perfect example of the family approach to religion, which is they want in on whatever exclusive club is going to be useful. Now, same going back to the genuine believer. I spent a long time with him. He's a genuine believer. But again, that's how it works. There's an ideology of power that allows people to believe that they're doing the right thing, that they're actually working for Christ. Sam Brownback thinks he is.
Well, of course, you know, when you start using Christianity to advance your political career, you just sort of have to you just have to wonder. Well, of course, Dan Brown, of course, popularized Opus Dei and his wonderful book on going into the background of Masonry. Forgot the name of the book just temporarily, but certainly they made it eventually into a movie with Tom Hanks. It was a great success. I think this was the first many people had ever heard of this secretive Catholic society, Opus Dei, but of course they never heard of its counterpart even to this day, and that's the family, and that's why I think your book is really so vitally important. And is it coming out in paperback? Is it going to be in hardback, the next printing of it?
It is in hardcover right now. The book, it made the New York Times bestseller list very briefly, so that keeps it in hardcover a little while longer. They want to sell as many hardcovers as they can. It will be in paperback probably middle of next year. Although, you know, the great thing with Amazon these days is that you can get hardcovers for paperback prices. So if someone wants to get it, they can get it. You know, you mentioned Dan Brown and his novel about Opus Dei, and I haven't read it, but I understand it's a very entertaining novel. But one thing I would say is I am wary of that comparison, because one of the things that has happened, I think, in American life, and we see this in our media, our mainstream media, not guys like you, Dr. Sander, asking the tough questions, but a lot of the press is able to look at a sensational account, a fictional account, and say, oh, well, then all this stuff must not be true. So, you know, Dan Brown builds his book as a novel. That's what it is. It's supposed to be read as a novel. And unfortunately, a lot of the press says, well, then we don't need to pay attention to all the Opus Dei. Well, yeah, Dan Brown's book is a novel. You know, you've seen the movie. There's no albino assassin. This is all fiction. This is, you know, the stuff for movies. But beyond that, there are real organizations wielding power. They're not necessarily as sensational, but in fact, they tend to be more influential. If we do the hard work, we can see that network of influence. There's a sociologist down at Rice University, evangelical himself, named D. Michael Lindsay, published this at Oxford University Press last year, did a survey of 360 top evangelical leaders in Washington. And I don't mean preachers and pastors and so on, but politicians who are evangelical. One in three, more than any other group, the family got a plurality of votes, named the family as the most influential, one of the most influential groups in Washington. As Lindsay said, he says, there's no other group to compare. That means more politicians that the family is more influential than James Dobson's Focus on the Family, than Chuck Colson's Prison Fellowship, than any of these other groups. The family's most... Now, here's the kicker. Here's a group that denies that it exists. The press should be all over this. Ronald Reagan in 1985 said, I'd like to tell you more about the family, the fellowship. He's spoken at the 1985 National Prayer Breakfast. He says, I'd like to tell you more about it, but I can't. It's working precisely because it's private. Well, now, if we had a functioning press, you tell the press, here's this powerful group and it's working because it's private, that's a call to investigate. Unfortunately, we do not have a functioning press right now.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you, and I really appreciate the fact that you actually have exposed what they're doing, and we hope to help you do that. Now, basically, how was it that you ever got the opportunity to go there and live for a time?
Well, you know, I mean, at the beginning of our conversation, I told the story of how this book, The Family, begins, and I tell the story in the book. I was invited to this guy. He said I went and met with him and to see if he had joined a cult. He was a family friend. And, you know, his family said, would you check it out? He joined a cult. He said, well, you've got to come and see what I've gotten involved in. So they invited me in, and you only get in by recommendation. And so I ended up living with them for about a month in Arlington, and just living with this house of young men who were all being sort of mentored by congressmen or ambassadors. I ran into all sorts of figures there, former former Attorney General Ed Meese, still very much a power broker in Washington.
Now, is Ed Meese is just a friend of the family? Is that where he fits in?
No, Ed Meese is quite a inside man. Ed Meese is an inner circle member of the family, and I sat in on some meetings with him that I just thought were frankly obscene. This was a man who was using the Bible as a justification for the enrichment and expansion of the power of more power for the powerful. So I was sort of wondering, you know, what the heck is going on here? And I discovered that they had dumped 600 boxes of documents at the Billy Graham Center in Wheaton, Illinois. So I actually moved out there and spent about 6 months just gathering documents, hundreds of thousands of documents I looked at, and then spent years sort of going through those. I went to the Ronald Reagan archives. I went through some papers of the Gerald Ford archives, just archives all over the country. And that's how I was able to reconstruct the story. At the same time, going and interviewing people through my work as a magazine journalist, talking to Senator Sam Brownback, or talking to any number of politicians and so on, and developing the picture like that.
Will you hold that thought for just a moment? We're going to be back in just a minute to wrap up the program, our guest this evening has been Jeff Charlotte, his book of the family, and we'll tell you a little later how to get it. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Jeff, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, Dr. Stan, I just want to thank you for having me on the show to talk about this book, The Family. And one of the things that I found most encouraging about this book is, you know, there's folks out there who say, this is just some kind of...
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt, that nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
Deaf Charlotte for his book, The Family, and we will be carrying it here at Radio Liberty. We've ordered them. We want you to have access to this and so much other information that is out there. Incidentally, we were wondering of trying to remember what the book was that Dan Brown had written. Of course, it was The Da Vinci Code, where he goes into the Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic society, just as The Family is a more or less a secret or semi-secret Protestant society or evangelical society. Call you what you will. There are many people that we associate with the evangelical movement there, but they're there for a different purpose. How do we understand this? Well, how do we understand the millions of dollars that and the countless millions of dollars that are involved in financing this worldwide movement? Well, you have to read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, to begin to understand the spiritual forces behind what's going on today. Because if we just look at the individual organizations, why, of course, we tend to get terribly, terribly confused. And that's the way it is supposed to be. You're not supposed to be able to see the forest for the trees. If you have not yet read Brotherhood of Darkness, we hope that you will, or get the CD, or I should say the DVD of it. You need to hear my talk on the forbidden secret, because there is a secret out there that has been suppressed for 5,000 years. You certainly would want to get my talk on the planned police state. There's a syllabus that goes with that as well. And here you'll actually get information written by people on the other side who are telling you exactly what they're wanting to do. For those of you, of course, who would like to get some information put out by the disciples of the prince of this world, we have something called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy, which the disciples have actually published. We distribute it free. If you get some of our other things, you specifically request it. You need to have the information. Now, certainly to really understand what's going on, we hope many of you are going to be able to come to our all-day conference. It's going to be on the 26th of October. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course here on the North Shore of Monterey Bay. A truly beautiful spot. And one of our guests is going to be Joanna Michelson, who was a medium. And she will tell you of her contact with the spiritual beings from the other dimension. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really is a spiritual dimension. We live in one dimension. There's a spiritual dimension where that great war, eternal war, has been fought since the beginning of mankind, and perhaps even long before that. Anyway, of course, if you're interested in coming, we'd love to have you. We're going to have Dr. Russell Blaylock. We're going to have Patrick Wood's going to be here talking about what's going on financially. And we're not going to have too many speakers. I think we're going to have five, including myself. We're serving lunch. You're going to have reservations. But I think you'll find it a fascinating program. We're going to start about 8:30 in the morning and go to 5:30 in the evening. Our telephone number is 1-888-24, our telephone number, if you'd like to make reservations, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, then we hope you'll go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. If you don't listen to our programs, or if you only can hear them occasionally, remember you can get them on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com and listen 9 hours a day. If you're interested in getting satellite, we have this up on satellite. Of course, you can listen 9 hours a day and not get anything at all accomplished. But we want you to get the information so you can give it to others. Now, we're moving into the most difficult and dangerous times of our nation's history. And, of course, we're seeing the end of the current financial situation, the current financial system. But something has got to break. If this financial system doesn't go down, we will certainly end up in a totalitarian dictatorship. Your job is to have the information and be able to tell others and explain to them the true spiritual nature of what's going on, and of course how this influences what's happening financially. I have a fear that God is about to bring his judgment upon this country for the sins of our people and for the sins of our leaders that we've allowed, and because they control both political parties and the elections are simply frauds. I tell again, please pray for America, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
Well,
this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and of course, hopefully, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Berlinski, who's written a fascinating book called The Devil's Delusion: Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. And, of course, Mr. Berlinski identifies himself as a secular Jew. And yet, of course, he's writing a fascinating book in defense of the, or at least in opposition to the scientists who claim that there is no God. And, of course, they claim that science has proven there's no God. And Mr. Berlinski, although he is not in any way a religious Jew, certainly challenges many of their suppositions, and he does a magnificent job. Now, you should know a little bit about Mr. Berlinski. He's basically a philosopher, and he teaches mathematics, and he actually lives in Paris, and he's just here for a short time. In fact, you're going to be going home very, very shortly, aren't you?
Tomorrow afternoon.
Well, I appreciate so much your taking time that's late back there where he is, but he's kind enough to be on with us today talking about the devil's delusion, atheism, and its scientific pretensions. And why don't you just tell us what motivated you to write a book of this sort?
Well, I think any writer who honestly answers that question has got to put personal vanity at the very head of the list. I'm really no exception. You know, anybody who writes wants to see his name in print. But beyond that, which is, I think it's a common feature of everybody who writes, I have to confess to a certain measure of irritability when I read Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and a whole crew of other people who are part of that bandwagon right now, trumpets blaring and the kettle drum booming. And I felt myself suffused with a mounting sense of indignation, chiefly because I thought that what this movement represents really deep down is a profound abuse of the magnificent cathedral of scientific thought. And that, I thought, needed to be confronted and rebutted. It sounds a little pretentious. I hear it in my own voice, but I think that's an honest assessment.
Well, of course, you know, as I read your book, and you point out the fact that whether, of course, if religion is true or not, if you don't have it, you have no moral values. In fact, at one point, you even quote one of these people who's opposed to, who is writing about stem cells. He wants, of course, to do stem cell research, fetal stem cell research, and he talks that it is morally indefensible to oppose, fetal stem cell research. Well, if there's no God, there's no morality. Certainly, morality is something we sort of make up on our own. Each man has his own morality. How can he accuse other people of being immoral for opposing something on a religious basis?
It's absolutely impossible. It's a point I developed with great pleasure in the book, because it is not only an important point, but in some respects it's an obvious point. I mean, the author you're citing is Sam Harris, and he is tremendously indignant that anyone could think to contravene a doctrine he's prepared to endorse, no matter the doctrine. And yet, when it comes to the defense of his doctrine, the claim that opposition that's based on religion is somehow unintelligible or irrational, he never tells us why. He never gives the slightest indication that there's an argument behind these claims.
Well, of course, if you look at, of course, stem cell research, you find out that fetal stem cell research doesn't work at all, because people, they get all sorts of immunity to it. And whereas, of course, the adult stem cell research is doing such wonderful things that maybe the religious objection to a fetal stem cell research had another purpose behind it, and that was to stop, simply experimenting something that wasn't going to work.
Well, maybe it's even simpler than that. Maybe it was designed to protect the intrinsic dignity of human life.
Well, that's that. I think you're absolutely right.
What is irrational about that?
Nothing at all. In fact, I agree with your basic precepts.
But isn't it odd that we both find it embarrassing to say something obvious, as if we're being forced by medical necessity to utter an obscenity? When was the last time anyone has uttered those words, the intrinsic dignity of human life, and really meant them? There's something that's absent from the discussion of that phrase is made suspect.
In fact, there's one point you made that was really very interesting to me. The people, of course, are talking about, of course, I think it was Christopher Hitchens, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was just talking about, of course, one of the big problems with religion. It kept people from enjoying their sex.
And yeah, imagine
sex
that.
Sex was really wonderful, and yet, we have to look and see what's happened.
Surely it's the opposite of the problem.
And it's created, you know, we have something like 60 million people in America with a sexually transmitted viral disease. That's independent of all the other sexually transmitted
but
diseases.
But here's the interesting question. Every single religious tradition since the dawn of man has found it necessary to introduce certain restrictions on sexual nature. This is not only the religious tradition. Every significant thinker has recognized that sexual desire is an immensely powerful, potentially destructive force. Of course it needs to be regulated. Of course we can't live in a society in which sexual desire is given complete freedom, free from any form of injunction and prohibition. Why is it necessary in the year 2008 to remark upon this? It's an obvious fact. And yet the objection to religious doctrine based on the claim that somehow or other it impedes the free enjoyment of sexual life is repeated again and again and again. It's not just Christopher Hitchens. Richard Dawkins says the same thing. His first commandment, have a great time.
Well, of course, sometimes it comes at a terrible, terrible price. And, of course, whether it's disease or psychologically, I mean...
Let's be honest, it always comes at a price. It always comes at a price.
Right. And, you know, really how tragic it is, of course, that all great religions certainly put curbs on sexual appetite.
And how?
And whether you agree with them or not, I happen to be an evangelical Christian, I can agree with them, but whether you agree with them or not, I mean, the point is if you do not have some sort of restraint, a moral restraint, you end up with social anarchy.
Of course you do. And you know, it's not just the insight of the religious tradition, it is a universal human insight. You look at Freud, for example, hardly a defender of a religious tradition, contemptuous of all religious life. But what is the great message that Freud argues? That civilization is fragile, it needs to be protected, and it is based on renunciation. This is Freud talking. Seems to me an immensely sensible message that each one of us is forced to learn in his or her own life.
Amen to that. We'll be back here in just a moment with David Berlinski. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. That's The Devil's Delusion. I think it's basically a very, very apropos title, because, of course, I believe, and I happen to believe in the devil. But be that as it may, certainly what we're seeing is the total breakdown of our society in the name of science. And, of course, as you point out so well in your book, I mean, these people are misusing science. In other words, science cannot prove there is a God, but science cannot prove there is not a God, and yet they pervert science to do that.
If I could interject, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but you know, if you rephrase that declaration, I think it's completely accurate as a characterization of their position. Instead of talking about science, talk about beekeeping, or bookkeeping for that matter. You realize just how inappropriate and ludicrous these kinds of claims really are. I mean, would we seriously entertain a speculation that bookkeeping shows there is no God? Well, no, we wouldn't. But if bookkeeping doesn't show that, why would quantum physics be in a better position to establish precisely the same sort of claim?
And so what you're really pointing out is these people hide behind science to justify their basic bias.
Of course they do. And again, I hate to sound like a broken record, but that point I think is an obvious point. It's misuse of the glorious tradition of the scientific establishment, which is a glorious tradition. I'm the first one to cherish and uphold it. But it's a glorious tradition with respect to the questions that it poses and the answers it provides. If I want to know something about the elementary particles, I'll look at the Standard Model of Particle Physics and I will be enlightened. If I want to know something about the ultimate nature of reality, the purpose of the universe, the presence of love in the cosmos, or whether there is or isn't a God, I'm not going to look at the Standard Model of Particle Physics.
These men, of course, are really very, very prominent in their fields, and in many respects, actually, to my way of thinking, have actually discredited science. And
that's the trouble. They are very prominent. I mean, somebody like Steven Weinberg, for example, is clearly a great scientist. He just doesn't know what he's talking about when he passes the boundaries of particle physics or relativity. He has the same standing as anyone else.
You make the point, of course, that they make the point that, you know, if there is no God, then anything is possible.
Do we need to, after the 20th century has been concluded and remains a living horror in the memory, do we need to be reminded of that point?
Well, I think
everyone in the 19th century said that, and they were all right. Perhaps we might learn from that.
And, of course, you use that idea, if there is no God, anything is possible. And, of course, with science, I've forgotten exactly how you put that, but science says that there is no God, and so, according to science, that everything is permissible.
I think that's exactly right. If there's no God, everything is permissible. If science is true, then there is no God. If science is true, then everything is permissible. That is a very frequently heard argument, very frequently heard. It seems very plausible to a great many people. And, of course, it's an argument that, in its consequences, is absolutely appalling. We know that. I mean, we don't have to cast around for a very elaborate metaphysical explanation. We know that a society that says to itself, everything is permissible, will do dreadful things.
And, of course, you use as an example of that the Nazis and, of course, their idea that they... In fact, I think it was Rudolf Hess who had actually said that, Nazism is simply applied science. And, of course...
They believed that.
They really did.
They believed that. And they drew the appropriate consequences that the human being is nothing but an accident of creation. And if there is no supervening moral agency in the cosmos, hey, why not do what we feel like doing? And in the case of Nazis, what they felt like doing was killing a whole lot of people. And they did.
But, of course, don't you think, of course, they were really sort of an offset of Darwinism and its godless concepts. And they really felt that they were improving the gene pool by doing away with groups that they felt were undesirable.
I think that's right. That's what they said to one another. The fact that they were largely stupid men, and that they had many, many scientific concepts inaccurately applied, I think that's beside the point. They looked upon themselves as being heirs to a particular kind of tradition in which, first of all, human beings were regarded as essentially accidents of creation, certainly not protected by any form of divine presence, and second of all, as if they were instruments of a system of Darwinian purification. Bear in mind, it's not necessary to claim that they got Darwin exactly right, that they read Origin of Species and understood it. They didn't. They were kind of dumb. The Nazis will never be counted among the great intellects of the human race. But nonetheless, what is crucial is the way they behaved and the kind of things they said to one another in justification. They always use this language, call it a degenerate form of Darwinism if you really want to protect the reputation of the master. And I have no objection to that. But nonetheless, excuse me, there is a current of thought that moves from the position that Darwin adopted in 1859, in which a human being is an accident of creation, and the law of biology is one of unceasing conflict between species, to the Nazis' view that the law of human society is one of unceasing conflict between races. There is that connection. It is foolish to deny it. We don't do any credit to Darwin by saying his ideas are so pure, so virtuous, so sanctimonious, that for some reason they could never possibly be misappropriated. That's not true.
No, and I think the Holocaust certainly is a perfect example of that.
I do, too.
And then, of course, you talk, in fact, you have a very impressive list there. It takes a couple of pages of the genocides that have taken place.
Since
the beginning of the 20th century. And it is shocking and horrifying as you see the fantastic number of people who have been systematically eradicated by governments in the name of expediency.
You know, I wrote that. I included that in the book. Obviously, the statistics are ones I've derived from the literature, but I included that because I came across this incredible claim by Steven Pinker, who is a professor at Harvard, professor of linguistics and psychology at Harvard. And he says, you know, the evidence indicates we're getting better and gooder and kinder and more generous. We don't whip our wives anymore. We don't mistreat animals. My goodness, what a spectacular instrument of progress 20th century secular society has really been. And you look at these kind of claims and you say to yourself, what world is this man living in? What distance from reality does he reside?
And, of course, this is really so true. If there is no God, then there are no moral standards. If there are no moral standards, then you end up just about the way we are today, unfortunately.
Well, the moral standards and thoughts of Richard Rorty, my professor at Princeton, was very troubled by this. And he was a sensitive man, and he was certainly not an ignorant man. And he finally came to the conclusion, because he was completely unwilling to countenance any form of theological commitment, that the only basis for moral judgments are more or less what a society makes up as it goes along. And I remember discussions with him. We came to the inevitable point. Well, what argument would you offer against Nazi Germany, against the Holocaust, against genocide? And he was honest enough to say, I have no arguments, except for aesthetic or artistic distaste, a sense of revulsion. But if that's the free expression of one society, if one society says, you know, what we like doing is killing a lot of people, and another society says we don't happen to like killing a lot of people, there is no grounds for rational reproach between the two societies. That's Rorty's position, and he admitted it. He just acknowledged it.
Well, you know, the impression you get from reading what these scientists, these so-called men of letters, and they're brilliant people, I certainly are. I do not tend to degrade their intelligence, except when it comes to this matter of the existence of God or absolute moral standards. And then it almost seems to be like a religious conviction founded not upon scientists, but upon their individual prejudice.
I think part of that's true. I think you have to, when you're talking about the intelligence of these figures or their level of learning or their insight, perspicacity or what have you, I think you have to pick and choose. Some of these guys are very intelligent. You know, we're among friends. We might as well admit it. Some of them are pretty dim bulbs, too. That's just to be expected. The idea that because a guy has a PhD after his name and teaches at Oxford that he's got to be a luminous intellect, we know better. We know better in the year 2008. The academic world is sort of a refuge. It has some interesting flora and fauna, but some pathetic specimens as well.
And, of course, the trouble is, though, if you are in academics, no matter where you are, and you are suddenly coming out and talking about your Christian or Jewish or even your Muslim faith and building upon your life model upon faith, you're going to come under tremendous pressure and discrimination.
Tremendous amount of snootiness, that's for sure. And better not admit those proclivities before you get tenure, I'll tell you that.
Especially, of course, if you believe that in creation and you believe that Darwin was wrong, that...
No. Just keep quiet about that one. Don't say a word.
But, you know, certainly we've always considered academics as this is where you can express, you know, ideas. You can condemn the administration.
My poor friend, you've had this belief for how long?
Well, I don't believe this, but theoretically this is the way it's supposed to be. And we both know that that's not the way it is at all.
What was it that Goethe said? Theory is gray, life is otherwise. You know, I spent 40 years in the academic world. That is the last conclusion I would endorse, that it's a place where freedom and diversity are cherished for themselves. It's not. It's not. It's an incredibly narrow-minded, orthodox, stifling environment. I bless the day I left the academic world.
Well, now, of course, do you still lecture in mathematics or philosophy?
Whenever I get a chance, sure. But mainly I write. I count myself as a writer rather than a lecturer. But of course, that's a matter of opportunity. Remarkably few people seem to want me to lecture anywhere.
Well,
I can't account for that.
How did you happen to find Paris, or go to live in Paris?
I picked it out from the map when I decided I had to get out of the United States for a while. It was just too claustrophobic. For personal reasons, you know, a happy marriage and need to escape. No, Paris sounded good. My parents had lived in Paris, and I had grown up on stories about Paris, and I had a few friends there.
Do you enjoy Paris today?
Yeah, very much. You know, I have to tell you the truth. I hardly ever leave my apartment. I don't do much. I don't take advantage of the city. I think it's a common complaint, you know.
And I've never seen such traffic. I remember being there in the 50s when I was in the military, and then going back, you know, 30 years later, and my goodness, it's almost worth your life.
Oh, try riding a motorcycle in Paris.
We'll be back in just a moment with David Berlinski. Go right ahead, you were saying.
Try riding a motorcycle in Paris traffic.
Oh, well, I guess the one thing that impressed me about Paris, of course, that all the cars seem to have dented fenders as if they were all running into one another like you would, you know.
Yeah, and if you're riding a motorcycle, it's not the car that has the dented fender, it's you.
Well, you don't ride a motorcycle, I hope.
I gave it up after I had a slight accident.
Oh, right.
I'm the only motorcycle rider in history to have fallen off the bicycle when it wasn't moving.
Oh, right. Well, anyway, of course, our guest this evening is David Berlinski, and of course, his book is The Devil's Delusion. And of course, I happen as an evangelical Christian to believe in the devil. I believe he's a very real force. But why did you, as a secular individual coming from the Jewish perspective, pick that as a title?
Well, it's interesting. You know, everybody said, you were just playing against the title that Richard Dawkins used. What was it? The God Delusion. And to be perfectly honest, my own defense, it never crossed my mind to use that that phrase because Richard Dawkins had used it. I used it for two reasons. One, it's a well-known theological idea that the ultimate refuge of the devil is to persuade people and is in existence. That's one idea. And the second is this wonderful quotation from Shakespeare where he says he must have a long spoon that must sup with the devil. So I wanted to put those two things together, and it seemed to work as a title. I think it expresses the theme of the book, the ultimate delusion, the devil's delusion.
Well, I really believe it is the devil's delusion, the old idea, do whatever, do what thou wilt, that's the whole of the law, and of course that's basically what happens. If you do not have any concept that there is a soul, that there is eternity, and that there is punishment for what we do. And, of course, you make that point as well, that certainly, whether it's real or not, the idea that, of course, we live and we die and then we are judged for what we've done is a restraint upon the excesses of activity.
And it's a very uncomfortable idea. One resists it with all one's force because the natural inclination of human beings, corrupt and sinful as they are, is to resist any constraints on their behavior. It's certainly been true in my life. I've resisted it all my life.
Well, of course, as you grow older, do you think there's a possibility that there may be a God?
Yeah, those, you know, 3 a.m. in the morning, you begin to reflect on that. And the first thing you begin to reflect is, my goodness, maybe it's too late.
Well, I don't think it's ever really too late. I'm 70, I'm 79, because I've been a Christian for many years, but I have no fear at all of death, because I know where I'm going. At least I believe I know where I'm going, and it really is a very, very consoling thing, especially when you may be facing going in for a surgical procedure, and you wonder if something might go wrong, and yet, of course, you say, well, if I die, this is not the end. I know where I'm going to spend eternity.
I comfort myself with the thought that if that should happen at my next surgical procedure, the world will go mad with grief. That gives me consolation.
Right. Well, after reading your book, I'm sure that many people will mourn your passing, but I certainly hope that this not happen to you.
Oh, me too. Me too. Don't get me wrong.
Right. Well, anyway, Chris, as you go through your... You use many standard arguments. Of course, you use the argument about all the excesses of religion. Of course, that's one of the things that's used against Christianity. Well, what about the Inquisition? What about the Crusades? I mean, how can you possibly defend Torquemada? And, of course, that immediately puts the Christians into a terribly defensive position.
I don't defend the Inquisition. I mean, curiously enough, just several months ago, I was at the Vatican of all places. Please don't ask what I was doing. I found myself at the office of the Inquisition, which still exists in the Vatican.
You hold that thought for just a moment as we bring other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. Fascinating reading, especially when we consider the theological background of the gentleman we're talking to, and yet I tend to agree with just about everything he's written. And he was just saying, of course, that we were talking about the fact that the The people who hate Christianity will always use the Inquisition, the Catholic Inquisition in Torquemada. They'll talk about the Crusades. I don't think you mentioned the Crusades, but that's the other thing that they always do. And pointing out to the violence and the injustice of these two things. And then David was just saying that, well, of course, it wasn't too long ago. He was actually at the Vatican, and you were there. Do you want to tell us what you were doing there?
For the life of me, I wish I could. I don't know. Somehow or other, it worked out that someone asked me to speak to the office of the Inquisition. And I actually had lunch with the two senior papal inquisitors. And the office still exists. Two nicer guys you couldn't possibly imagine. And we discussed all these issues. It's clear that I had no standing to discuss it. I'm not, in any sense, integral to the Catholic faith. But they were very honest, and we had a very frank, interesting discussion.
Well,
of course,
sure.
My position was that they should stop apologizing for Galileo, for heaven's sakes. They were right, after all. He was a remarkable pest in his dealing with the Inquisition. But the basic point they made, and I think they made a completely correct point, is, look, there's a big difference between violating or not living up to the standards of, say, the Christian faith as expressed in Catholic doctrine, and having no standards whatsoever. That is the real distinction, the disjunction of thought. Yes, the church did commit excesses, but it committed excesses in the name of a very lofty spiritual standard, which it abused. But let's not confuse the existence of the standard and the violations of the standard. Those are two different things. This is particularly galling when you reflect on someone like Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or any of these people.
And, of course, these people are just so violently anti-Christian, anti-religious.
It's such a false violence. It's such an act of self-deception. And you know, when a Christopher Hitchens gets up in the morning and he goes to shave and he sees his beaming face in the mirror and he says to himself, you know, that's a pretty nice face, and the world would be a pretty nice place if people were pretty much like me and we could live in a spirit of enlightenment, tolerance, feelings of goodwill toward one another, abundant sexual pleasures, enjoy the moment while we can. And not even for a second does he realize that he is not the author of that faith. He's the beneficiary of a 2,000-year-old Christian tradition that's given him his faith. And he simply doesn't recognize it. All the things he holds as virtues, the spirit of equanimity, the spirit of good-naturedness, the spirit of indulgence, the spirit of tolerance, the spirit of fairness, he didn't create that for himself. If that face and the body that goes with it were removed to pagan Rome or antique Greece, it would find the world a remarkably strange, different, brutal place. It would be horrified by what it sees. Something did happen in the experience of the human race with the introduction in the West of the Christian faith. It's unmistakable. I'm saying this as a Jew. It's simply the truth. And when these guys look in the mirror and draw trite and trivial conclusions from what they see without ever recognizing the historical continuity that has shaped their view of the world, one can only talk in terms of self-deception.
Very well said. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Do you don't mind taking calls, do you?
Me? No, I love them.
All right, fine. Again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And our guest is David Berlinski. We're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion. And, of course, coming from the point of view of a secular Jew, really, we have to recognize the fact that whatever your religious faith is, the world is a better place because there are moral standards and there are people who believe in God, and it's changed the world. And of course,
how could you deny it?
Well, I couldn't deny it.
I'm asking. I know you would. I know. I didn't mean to insinuate that. I wasn't suggesting you were adopting an antagonistic position. But I'm saying rhetorically, it seems to me, in my partiality and ignorance, that is an overwhelmingly plausible point.
And, of course, it's really what makes life worthwhile. In fact, if in my way of thinking, if there is no God, then life is really sort of a futile. And, you know, the old adage that life is tough and then you die, or, you know.
That's kind of a bleak panorama, isn't it?
It sure is. Well, you know, but, of course, being involved in what I believe is the great spiritual battle that is being fought out today, life is exciting. Every day we get up in the morning to do our 7 o'clock in the morning program, and at least we have an opportunity of being heard by a few thousand people. And hopefully it's having an impact in their thinking. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And when we get back, I'll let David tell you how to get hold of a copy of his book, The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretenses. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Berlinski, and Chris, he's written a fascinating book challenging the leading scientists of our day, or some of the leading scientists of our day, who've come out openly and, of course, attacking Christianity, attacking a belief in God. And, of course, they can do that. They write their books, and there's nobody there to challenge them. You write a book, then that comes out as a definite statement of fact. And then, of course, along comes David Berlinski, certainly with excellent academic credentials, having taught philosophy and having taught mathematics, and certainly coming from the intellectual point of view. And then he simply challenges these leaders of the scientific community and points out the fallacies of their arguments. Are you having any counters? Are you having any opposition to your views?
I think it's a little early. Don't forget the book really was published April 1st.
Oh, I didn't realize it. Of course, it was just that recent then.
And it hasn't really gotten into the bookstores yet. It's available on Amazon. They're great. I mean, they've got a huge stock of the books. But the bookstores haven't really gotten their shipments yet, so I suspect it's a little early. On the other hand, it's entirely possible that my views will be ignored forever. Entirely possible.
Well, because that's really one of the best ways, of course, to neutralize a view that you oppose.
Yeah, but I'm counting on their wounded pride. I'm really banking on that.
Yeah, you know, but you're hoping that you can open the dialogue.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course I am.
Well, I certainly hope that you can as well, because you're going to present your positions very well. And Chris,
thank you.
And their positions are really very indefensible. In fact, they're really based upon a faith.
What's interesting? They're very fragile. You know, you handle them for a few minutes, they just crumble like so many cakes of soap that have been exposed to the sun.
And, of course, the arguments are just so straightforward. I mean, how can you possibly use science to disprove the existence of God? And yet that's the statement they make. And yet you can't disprove anything. It's hard enough to prove things, but even harder to disprove them.
What's interesting is that when you actually look at what, say, a Richard Dawkins says, Chapter 4 of The God Delusion, he introduces an argument, and he smacks his forehead and says to himself and to his readers, of course, my God, is this ingenious. Nobody's ever thought of this one before. You go back 8 centuries, and you read Aquinas, the Summa Theologica, there it is, in its full complexity, set out with magnificent lucidity in medieval Latin. Aquinas examines the argument, he holds it up, he smacks it on its bottom, he turns it upside down, and then he dismisses it, because it's a puerile argument. And he goes on to state the correct conclusion to be drawn from premises that Richard Dawkins has introduced. Dawkins has an infinite regress argument. If you believe God created the universe, then who created God? Well, there are two things wrong with the argument, even if you can't answer
hold
the
that, hold that thought for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, David Berlinski, and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Delusion, which incidentally has only come out just a couple of weeks ago, and so we're fortunate to get an early copy of the book, and of course to have Mr. Berlinski on before he goes back over to the Paris, where he's currently living and writing, and of course having taught for 40 years in academics, he certainly has the prestige to challenge many of the scientists who are using, in the name of science, an effort to destroy a belief in God. Whereas, of course, there's no way they can do that. Please, you were making a point, and I interrupted you.
You know, it's late at night. Was I making an important point?
Oh, I'm not sure where we were going to go with that, but that's all right.
I was talking about Richard Dawkins. I remember that, and I was arguing that. Oh, I remember that Aquinas, for example, anticipates every one of his arguments and rejects them. It is only somebody who is flamboyantly and willfully ignorant of the tradition he's addressing that could possibly write these sort of things in the year 2008. That seems to me astonishing, and also the fact that he hasn't been called on that seems to me very reproachful with respect to the academic world. You know, there are plenty of scholars who know better, plenty of scholars.
Well, of course, but most of them do not want to come out in defense
not
of
one.
Christianity. We have to, of course, what we need, of course, is Christian theologians. But then, of course, you have the advantage of nobody who's ever going to accuse you of prejudice. You're simply looking at it from the philosophical point of view and from point of view of are the arguments valid and the arguments really are not valid.
They're good. They're just no good.
Well, do you have a website out there where you discuss any of these things?
I really should, right?
You really should.
This is embarrassing. This sort of question. You know, I'll give you the truth, if that's permissible.
Yeah, of course it is. But
I am so technically incompetent that I couldn't begin to set up my own website, and my children only laugh at me when I suggest it.
Well, unfortunately, my son puts up our website and does an excellent job.
Yeah, my kids put up a website for themselves.
I see.
And I'm locked out of it. I can't access that one.
All
but,
right.
You know, I'll just have to live with my limitations. Me and the computer, we don't get along. So
all right, fine. Well, anyway, here's the book, The Devil's Delusions, available from Amazon.com. That's all you need to know. It may be on Barnes & Noble's. And
I think Barnes & Noble's got it, too, on their website, whatever it is.
Under any circumstances, it's a book that's well worthwhile reading because we have to be able to, of course, to address these arguments. And, of course, as a Christian and certainly a person who gets into these arguments, these discussions all the time on the radio, it's important that we have a means of knowing how to address it. The other side...
Well, I agree completely.
...has all of these very, very convincing arguments. And if you haven't thought them through ahead of time, and you're on the radio and there are 10,000 people or 20,000 people listening, and you don't have the answer, you're in real trouble. So
I know. You know, some of the arguments are so childish and yet so effective that it's embarrassing to recount them. You get a Sam Harris coming on a radio show saying to you, for example, well, do you believe in Zeus? What are you going to say? Well, no, I don't happen to worship Zeus. And the counter is, well, why believe in God? And it takes a moment before you realize the evident nonsensical quality of that kind of asseveration. If you don't believe in Zeus, belief in God is irrational.
Well, of course, the thing is that in the course of a discussion, especially in a debate situation, why, of course, you've got to be very quick on your feet. I can see that you are, even at this late time.
It's amazing to me that I'm able to keep functioning.
Well, I'm glad you can, because otherwise I'd be doing an hour's monologue here. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24.
I'm just warming up my tonsils now. I'm ready to go to the next hour.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're listening out there across America, you have a question or comment for Dr. David Berlinski, why we'd love to hear from you, because I think that it's so important that you know how to defend the faith against these very, very superficial arguments. And, of course, how do you defend against the charges of the Inquisition? How do you defend against the charges of certainly the hypocrisy that we've seen many, many times within the Catholic Church or within the Protestant Church? And, of course, we have to have a framework to be able to do what you have to do best, and that is to put the opposition into a defensive position. What they want to do, and I've learned this through the debate, is put you into a defensive position.
Of course.
What you have to do is turn it around and put them into a defensive position. Well, I really hope that you have the opportunity, of course, to get some of these people into an open debate, either on radio or on television, or even sometimes certainly a debate on the Internet in a series of essays, point and counterpoint.
I would be delighted. I'm looking forward to doing all those things. I hope that I'll have the opportunity to do it. But, you know, it's as you remarked very perceptively, to ignore a critical position is perhaps the easiest way to defend an indefensible position.
Amen to that. Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line, but they haven't told me who they are, calling from across America. People, a lot of our listeners, of course, on the East Coast this time of evening, and it's getting late for them as well, but we appreciate their being there. Well, certainly as we go through your... The whole thing, of course, you deal a great deal with the Holocaust, and just the insanity of this whole tragedy as it unfolds, and the tremendous impact it's had on the lives of so many tragic people. And of course, you know, the fact that today there are people who actually still deny that the Holocaust ever took place is beyond concepts, my concepts, because I've had an opportunity to talk to some of the people who were at Auschwitz and did survive.
And that yet, was course, the final prediction of the SS. I don't know whether you know this, that in the last days of the war, when the SS communicated one to another, when they realized that they were going to be not only defeated, but they were facing themselves physical destruction because the Soviets were pledged to eliminate anyone who wore an SS uniform, they claimed for themselves a particular privilege, and the only word to describe it is diabolical. They said they had committed the worst crimes in human history and that no one would believe it.
I thought that was just such a very valid point when you put it forward. Let's go to Richard, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Richard. Did you have a question for our guest?
Yes. The question is about the author of a book you mentioned, I think, sort of refuting the existence of God. And I thought you, I wasn't sure whether you said Richard Dawkins or Richard...
Richard Dawkins. Ball. Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins, yes. Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Okay, that was my question. I think I'm sort of familiar with that book and work. I just wanted to clear up that point.
All right, anything else?
That was interesting. Thank you.
All right, fine.
You're
welcome. Let's go to John, who's calling from...
Hello?
Hi,
hello?
John. Where are you from in New York? What's that city?
Oneonta.
Oh, that's the reason I didn't recognize it. Okay, does you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I got a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
And a question sort of wrapped up in one. Our culture has been predominantly a Christian culture, and we have been overly confident in our beliefs at the expense of other cultures. Yet we have no proof of what our belief is based on. It's a faith.
Are you talking about the United States right now?
Or Western culture?
Hello?
But I think, go over, ask your question again, please, Rich, David.
My question is that our culture, our Western culture, is based on the Judeo-Christian faith.
Right.
Yes.
And we have been overly confident in the past centuries as our way is the only way, it's the truth. Yet we have done this at the expense of many cultures, and we have ignored knowledge that these cultures could have given us over time.
I think to a certain extent that is true, but I also suggest that in the early part of the 21st century, it is a mistake to talk about overconfidence in the West. In fact, I think quite the reverse is true. It's a terrible crisis of confidence, because having been forced to admit perhaps that we have failed to learn as much as we could possibly learn from other cultures, we have come increasingly to doubt what we should not doubt at all, is that we live in a culture of extraordinary ingenuity and intellectual fertility that has made possible a remarkable society. That shouldn't be placed so stringently in doubt, I think. I think that's a mistake. By all means, let's admit that we can look at the historical record and say some things are appalling in Western culture, some things are outrageous, some things should never have taken place. But to suggest that we suffer in 2008 a real crisis of overconfidence, I think, is a mistake. What is really manifest in the United States and certainly in Western Europe is a tremendous crisis of the spirit, a seeming inability to confront the obstacles in front of us, to deal manfully with what we need to deal with.
And I would point out, John, that I'm 79. I live in an entirely different world today than the one that I lived in. For the first 20 years of my life, America was a far different nation at that time, an entirely different set of values, and we're progressively eroding the Judeo-Christian character of our nation, and also there have been some wicked, wicked people in positions of power who've done some terrible things in the name of America, whether it be the Spanish-American War or the Philippine-American War, which most Americans have never even heard of, where, of course, we slaughtered several hundred thousand Filipinos, bringing them freedom. Did you want to comment on that, David?
I said up to a million were killed.
Right, right. In your book, you said 220,000, but of course the figure is certainly up to a million. Most Americans never even heard of the Filipino-American War. So, John, what we need to do is cling to the good, recognize the bad, and certainly be willing, of course, to be critical where criticism is justified. Anything else you'd like to say?
Yes, what I would really like to press on is that we have minimized what other people can contribute to our society for the sake of pressing on the word.
Because we have, on
a lot of occasions, made our belief to be like the crux, the cornerstone, what is fundamental. And we fail to emphasize that it's simply a faith, such as Islam, Buddhism, and all these things, that they're simply faith. And to attribute our success of the culture for the technology and whatever kind of diminishes the fact that we are emphasizing a faith, and we should not give other people the impression that our faith is dogma.
All right, fine. John, really, which one of these other countries would you like to live in?
What other country would I?
Well, I mean, would you like to live in a Shinto country? Would you like to live in a Buddhist country? Would you like to live in a Hindu country?
I've lived in a lot of countries. I've lived in Italy. I've lived in France.
But these are all part of Western civilization, Christian civilization.
All right. Tanzania is not a Christian country.
What's that?
Tanzania is an African country.
You're right. You're absolutely right. No, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking of where you were talking about, Italy and European countries. Anyway,
yes.
Thank you so very much for calling. Appreciate your thoughts. And our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment for our guest this evening, David Berlinski, we'd love to hear from you. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. And we're basically talking about how do you defend our civilization, Western civilization, a Judeo-Christian civilization, because, of course, Christianity came out of the cradle of Judaism, and the two of them, of course, are intricately melded, even though we may have different views on some things, that we have a common belief in many of the fundamentals of society that have transformed the lives of women, have transformed society, have made for a very humane society, in contrast to so many of the other societies that exist throughout the world today. So, Cindy, you have a section in here on the Muslim faith. Would you like to elaborate a little on that?
Well, I'm of two minds. I think one should always begin by saying there is something that did come over the United States and certainly in Europe after September 11th, some penetrating vision of the evil that's possible in the name of a radical theological movement. Anyone who is blind to that is not living in the early part of the 21st century. And I think some motivation for the new atheism can be tracked directly back to September 11th, this feeling of horror. What is possible? What is really possible? And what could be possible if, for example, nuclear weapons fell into the wrong hands? But that having been said, I'm also appalled at the extent to which intellectuals, academics, scientists, certainly the guys who are contributing to the new atheist movement, in the first place know absolutely nothing about the Muslim tradition. That is, have not studied its texts in any serious way, do not understand the nature of the creedal commitment they express, have no understanding of the life that is lived, and consequently have no appreciation of the fact that there are at least 1 billion people out there. That's many, many people, 1 billion people out there who look with a certain concern at the nature of a secular society and find it within their hearts possible to reject some aspects of a secular society. There's a great unwillingness to confront this for what it really is, a kind of judgment rendered upon us of all people, by 1 billion other people who find themselves very, very much at odds with the nature and inclination of a purely secular society. That's something we need to come to grips with in a much better way. The discussion has to be more inclusive. I'm agreeing with your last caller to some extent. It has to be more penetrating. It certainly has to be more sympathetic. Certainly has to be more sympathetic, because when you have a situation in which 1 billion people say, you know, we admire, we appreciate the glory of Western culture, certainly its technology, because we embrace it every chance we have, and we don't wish to live lives of desperate poverty, but deep down there is something that we find deeply off-putting about secular societies. That's something we should acknowledge.
Well, of course, you know, as I see what's happening today as far as relationship with the Muslim nations, I'm sure you're well acquainted with Samuel Huntington's book,
sure,
The Class of Civilizations. And he warned us against, you know, trying to impose our beliefs on the Muslim world. He said this is just going to be a quagmire, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Unfortunately, I think that's right. But, you know, that very often becomes a question of political strategy, what to do when faced with the exigencies of a particular political situation, about which I cannot speak because I know nothing about it. But beyond that, I think there's the important element of judgment. And the talk of the Islamic faith is to talk about one of the three great world religions, in many respects, a religion with immense appeal. We can spend hours discussing why it should have this appeal, but the fact that it does have this appeal, that it answers to certain human needs in a very powerful way, seems to me undeniable, and a fact too easily overlooked.
And, of course, I think that the standards of morality, we may disagree with some of the forms of punishment in the Muslim faith.
No, I do. I do, of course.
Women. But, I mean, here's a faith that stresses charity, prayer, and certainly integrity. And most Muslims, you know, are really very nice people.
Of course. That should go without saying, but it doesn't.
And it doesn't either because we don't understand the Muslim faith, and we tend to equate it with jihad and what happened on September 11th. Well, hang on just a moment here, and we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, we have actually 3 minutes to wrap up the program. So what are the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners out across America?
I don't know that I have any particular pearls of wisdom to offer. I think this has been an immensely instructive kind of discussion. You know, I've had it again and again and again on the radio. I'm always astonished that when you push away the debris of polemics and the irritability and anger that the discussion provokes, it's just amazing to me what a deep hunger there is for clarity and clarification and a certain measured degree of wisdom on these issues. You know, everyone, even those most vigorous in their denunciation of religion, everyone is in roughly the same position. We're all groping. We're all uncertain. We're all, to a certain extent, confused. We all wish that there would be more light, and we're searching for the light. Every last one of the people I've interacted with basically has the same attitude, the same opinion. They're confused about the way those opinions and attitudes could best be expressed, and, you know, so am I. There's no harm in saying that. There's no harm in saying that. What we need to do is reject the fearful dogmatism of any position on the compass. The fearful dogmatism of the scientific elite happens to be my particular target. I'm sure there are other dogmatisms to combat. And just appreciate the imponderable nature of these questions and how important they really are and how we could not successfully live as human beings without them.
And, of course, I think we can all agree that we need some sort of a concept of something greater than ourselves that we would be answerable to or whatever that...
Otherwise, we perish.
Right. And if there is no God, why, of course, to me, life has very little, if any, meaning. Well, you know, I think it's fascinating. Chris, I know that you've been very, very busy because we've been trying to get you onto our program, for the weeks that you've been here. And every time we have you lined up for a program, why, you have an opportunity to go on some larger program. And so,
that's not true. I reject that. I've always been eager to be on your program. I've always placed that number one on my list of priorities. You know, I don't choose these things. The person who's handling public relations arranges my entire life for me. When I get up, when I go to sleep, where I go to lunch, everything.
Well, of course, they have done a very, very good job of protecting you, and they were very nice about, of course, getting you on this evening, for which I was very, very grateful. And
me too.
They are people that, of course, at Spence Publishing that got you on, do an excellent job of promoting books. I don't think they published your book, did they?
No, it's Crown Forum that published it.
All right, fine. Well, they do this public relations for a number of other publishers as well as their own books. Anyway, I want to thank you so very much. It's been a fascinating hour, and I wish you well, and I'm looking forward to your next book.
Thanks very, very much for having me on.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
All right, fine. Well, that was David Berlinski. Of course, his book is The Devil's Delusion. Fascinating. It's a very readable book that will help you to really be able to argue for the Christian faith. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I do hope you've enjoyed our conversation with David Berlinski, who approaches really the discussion of the defense of Western civilization and Christian civilization based upon the fact that he is a secular Jew, but he objects to the arguments that are being used by the so-called scientists, using science to prove there is no God, where, of course, they really can't do that. And he recognizes that really, of course, whether God is real or not, man has to believe in him. Man has to have a belief in something greater than himself. I'm often reminded of that wonderful movie Ulysses, of course, where, of course, the hero stands on the beach after having been kept away from his family for many years following the Battle of Troy. And he cries out on the beach to the waves, "Why are you doing this? Why are you keeping away from home?" And, of course, this voice comes from the depths. And it says, "Because man cannot live without his gods." And even though, of course, this is, purely fictional, I believe it's very, very true. We do need a God. Now, I believe that Christian faith is the true faith. I believe, of course, unfortunately, it is not practiced as it should be. And I believe there is tremendous corruption within the structure of organized religion. But that does not in any way detract from the beauty of the Bible, God's holy word. And it is the answer to all of man's needs, if properly applied. Well, our telephone number, of course, is 1-800-544-8927. If you'd, of course, like to, of course, get some of the material we put out, because, of course, we point out that there is an organized effort to destroy Christianity, and this is really through the occult organizations. There really are millions of people who worship a different God. And, of course, if you'd get our talk on the forbidden secret, and, of course, the syllabus goes with that. Our talk on the planned police state not only talks about the fact that we are moving towards a police state, but why. And, of course, what are these forces behind the scenes? And we actually provide you with some of their material. Again, the telephone number, the title is The Planned Police State. And there's an excellent syllabus for that, which will give you the documentation that you need, of course, to be able to convince others that there really is a plan in case of a national emergency, which can be contrived at any time, to suspend the Constitution and the right of habeas corpus and begin rounding up American citizens and put them into concentration camps. And we do hope that many of you out there will get our material. And we have a four-tape set on concentration camps. We have a DVD. It's entitled America, Behind Barbed Wire, put together by our good friend David Wagner. We have, of course, some of the documents going into the background. We actually have something called Amazing Clips, but there you'll see the Iran-Contra hearings, where, of course, they tried to bring out that there was this plan, and of course, the Congressman Jack Brooks was silenced by Senator Inouye, who did not want the American people to know about this plan, that everything is in place for the establishment of a dictatorship. And people say it just can't happen here in America. And I would simply reply, why not? If God is just, he's going to bring judgment on this country in a terrible, terrible way. So let me suggest again the talk on the forbidden secret, very important. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, very important. And, of course, you can get the DVD of that if you want to. The DVD on the planned police state and the syllabus goes with that. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, 4-hour, 10-hour version, because it introduces you to the demonic element that is at work within our society today. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get the excellent DVDs, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and then the second of the series, Riddles in Stone. I have a small part in both of those. What I have to say is not that important. It's the overall theme, that there have always been two forces at work in America. One, a strong Christian group, a movement, dedication, and then, of course, the demonic organizations, which are not imaginary, but are really very, very real, intent upon destroying our nation. Our telephone number.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening. ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is Friday. It's Take a Deep Breath Day. It's, oh my gosh, it's finally...